Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Back in 2015, the migration crisis in Europe was in headlines all over the world. Thousands of people fleeing countries like Syria, Afghanistan, and Eritrea drowned in the Mediterranean. More than a million others made it to Europe, though not all of them found a warm welcome. Since then, the numbers of people crossing the Mediterranean has declined dramatically. Last year, the International Organization for Migration counted 363,000 arrivals, and from January to September 3rd of this year, just 126,000. Now, the main reason for this drop was a 2016 deal with Turkey that has largely closed the main sea route from Turkey to Greece. But many problems still remain, not least for tens of thousands of migrants who arrived in Europe over the past few years and still find themselves in legal limbo. Now, on this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to look at Europe's immigration problems from a few different angles. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from a couple of policy experts who will look at what the EU and Europe's governments have and haven't done right. We'll also speak with an aid worker in Calais, France, where hundreds of migrants still sleep in the woods outside the city, hoping to find their way across the English Channel to the United Kingdom. But first, we're going to meet Mehdi Shams. He's a Pakistani asylum seeker who spent 6 months trying to get to Europe. He arrived on the Greek island of Lesbos in July 2016, and he's still in a crowded refugee camp there, where he joins us via Skype. Mehdi, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us if you would, let's just start briefly at the beginning. Tell us why you left Pakistan for Europe.
Because in Pakistan, many people know that there is a racism fight, like war there. And there is Islamic problems, which we are in minority, and I was living in one of the biggest province of Pakistan. His name is Balochistan, and there is many target killings, bomb blasts every day, and they want to kill the Shia community mostly. Which Shia community in Balochistan, they are in minority, and they don't like us. It's a kind of big policy because Baloch people, they are killing us because they don't like the Hazara people, Hazara community, and they don't like the Pashtuns also. Because they are saying that Balochistan is an independent country. They are not counting the Balochistan as a province.
So in other words, then you're a Shia in a mostly Sunni country. You're an ethnic minority in a part of the country where the Baloch people are the majority. You felt threatened there. But tell us, if you would, about your trip from Pakistan to Greece. How did you get to where you are right now?
It's a very hazard journey. I came through Afghanistan. I went to Afghanistan first, and from Afghanistan to Iran, Iran, Turkey, and Turkey to Greece. In this way, we faced many, many troubles. Few of our friends, they was near of dying. Most of them was sick, and they started their journey towards towards Europe because their life was in threat, When we in Turkey also, at the mostly the for Afghan people, the dangerous part is from Iranian border to Turkey border, which is very hard to pass it, because the Iranian police officers, they have a shoot sight order, which they can shoot you. They have an order, and no one can ask them a question that why you shoot the people. And on the Turkey side, they also allow, and they also can beat you all. And on the way, when you cross the border parts, in the city, there is many troubles, it's really hard for the refugees to stay there.
Well, let me just stop you there, because you said there was difficulties with security forces in Iran mistreating migrants, and then once you got to Turkey, how did you get to Greece from Turkey? I understand that you went by sea, but how was that journey?
That journey is also is a kind of very hard, and on the second time I entered in Greece, the first time when we were from, I was in Istanbul, and then we went to Izmir. From Izmir, we tried to come to Greece, in which we start our journey at the night time, and the Turkish Coast Guard, they caught us in the, from the center of the sea, and they took us back. And what happened? What happened there? It was a kind of surprising for me. In the UNHCR, the officials camp, UNHCR camp, they took us our fingerprints, pictures, and we was wondering that okay, they will take us to the camp. But unfortunately, this thing not happened. They just take our fingerprints and picture. They ask money, each person 30 euro, and we paid the 30 euro, and we got released, and we went to terminal back to Istanbul, from Istanbul back to another city. On the second time, I don't know from which part we came, because we was in the van and it was so dark we wasn't allowed to see the
okay. So your first effort to cross, you were picked up by the Turkish Coast Guard, you were brought back, eventually you were released, and then you made a second attempt to cross. Yeah. This part of the Mediterranean to get to Greece in an open boat, an inflatable boat, I guess. Talk to us about what happened the second time.
In the second time, like it was early morning. We start our trip towards Greece, and as the smugglers are saying to refugees that just go one and a, you have to drive only 1.5 hours, and then you will be entered in Europe, which is totally lie. It's not the way that they are saying. So, in the second time, we our boat was stuck in the center at the center of the sea, which. We was so uncomplicated, like it's a very unstable situation, like we were so quiet, no one is speaking any word, and we came with the idea like we can all turn on our cell phones, which we opted like before sitting before climbing in the, on the in the boat. We turn on our cell phones, GPS. We say like it's international water, for sure somebody can trace our signals, and this thing happened. And after 10 minutes of being stuck in the center of the sea, the Swedish Coast Guard, they came to pick up us, and then they are before changing our boat, they ask us many like some typical questions like what happened, why your boat was stopped. So we gave the answer like our motor is
not
working.
So you were picked up by the Swedish Coast Guard off of Greece, and eventually you were taken to a Greek refugee camp. And our time does grow short, but if you could, just for our last question, talk to us about conditions inside this Moria refugee camp where you are. What's it like to live there? What are your living conditions like?
The living condition is terrible. Before coming here, I wasn't I was aware of the situation, but that not that much bad. Like. Here at the moment, the capacity of this camp of Moria, the capacity of Moria camp is about for 2,000 people, in which 5,000 people are living at the moment, and still people are coming. And in every second step, we have problems everywhere, and like we have a food, we have a washing, like we don't have a regular water, we don't have a regular good foods, like we don't have a clothing space. And we have people are living in the tents, and now the winter is coming, and more people are landing in this island, which is a sign of danger, because the winter is a big challenge for everyone to pass it. As the last year, in the winter we lost 7 people.
It sounds like a very difficult situation there. I'm sorry for this. We're just out of time right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, a look at Europe's continuing struggle to deal with the 1.5 million migrants who have crossed the Mediterranean since 2015. We just spoke with Mehdi Shams, a Pakistani asylum seeker who's been held in a Greek refugee camp for over a year. Now we'll move to Calais in northern France, just across the English Channel from the British city of Dover. That's where a huge migrant camp known as the Jungle was famously demolished by French authorities last year. But many migrants still remain, hoping to find their way to England. Now to hear more, we're joined by Maya Conforti, an aid worker with the group L'Auberge des Migrants. Maya, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us about the situation for migrants right now in Calais. There was a camp of this Jungle camp that was destroyed by police right now, but the people are still there. Tell us about the situation.
Yes, so there is no more jungle, but there are still people. And in fact, because there is no more jungle, the situation is actually worse than it was before. There's just less people. We only have 700 people, but it's 700 people who live on the street, sleep outside. Right now we have British weather, so it's raining cold, and the winter is going to be upon us soon. They have no We are not allowed to give them tents. We can only give them sleeping bags and blankets. However, the French police goes out every night and wakes up those people wherever they're sleeping in the grass, tells them to move on, and if they don't move on, uses tear gas on them and takes the sleeping bags and the blankets and throws them in the trash. And they do that every single night.
Well, that's what you described there sounds quite disturbing, but tell us just first, I want to hear more about this. Who are these migrants? Where do they come from?
Okay, so mostly they come from Eritrea and Ethiopia or Sudan, actually mostly from Eritrea. So they do not come from Turkey, they come from Libya. So they still cross the sea from Libya into Italy. And among those Eritreans, we have a huge number of minors because they are all trying to avoid the lifelong military service that they're supposed to do in Eritrea.
And now there has been a lot of criticism by groups like Human Rights Watch and others of how the French police have been treating these men. Tell us just a little bit more about that. You described them, the people having tear gas sprayed in their faces while they're camping out. What's the situation there right now?
So it is like this absolutely every single night and even during the day. Basically, the French government has a politics of discouragement. They think that if they make it life as hard as possible for the refugees, they will end up moving on and going elsewhere. However, they came a long way. They want to go to the UK, and so they're staying. The police is being very violent with the refugees in Calais. And not only in Calais, they're doing the same thing in Paris. They're not letting refugees, sit down for more than a couple of hours anywhere at any time during 24 hours.
And it sounds like there has been an adversarial relationship, not just between the migrants and the French police, but also between aid workers and like yourself and people who are trying to help them.
Yes, so we have had to actually take the government to court for them to actually follow their own law, like providing access to water to those 700 people and some toilets and some showers. We won in court, but the French government is still trying to buy time to install showers, for example. They lost in the court case 2 months ago, and they still have not installed the showers. And they've also tried to make us stop distributing food. They're requiring from our association, sanitary standards for a kitchen that are completely overboard, things like that.
So, sort of through regulations, they're trying to slow down or halt some of the aid work that's happening there, it
Yes,
sounds like.
they.
Well, tell us if you would. Some critics would say, I heard you use the word refugees to describe these men. Some critics would say not all of them do fit that category of refugees who are fleeing, are sort of political refugees or are fleeing violence. So these are people who are economic migrants who are looking for jobs and a better life, and that's a different category of people. What's your
Well,
take?
is it a different category? First of all, any country that's at war or has political problems obviously also has economic problems. So making the difference between the two is very difficult to start with. And also, what is you think about Americans, they are made out of migrants from Europe that have left for America to try to make a better life. We as Europeans also do that in other countries. How come not everybody has the right to do this? That's a question to answer.
Well, Maya Comforti, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
A reminder that this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. If you've just tuned in, we're talking today about Europe's continuing struggles to deal with the 1.5 million migrants who have crossed the Mediterranean since 2015. If you're interested in more coverage of underreported international and human rights news, visit us at globaljournalist.org. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the videocast of this program on YouTube. Now, up next, we're going to talk about the big disagreements within the European Union, about what to do with all these people and who should be responsible for them. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mike Gonzalez. He's a former foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and other publications, and has reported from Brussels as well as many other international posts. He was also a speechwriter in the State Department's European Bureau in the George W. Bush administration. He's now a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mike, welcome. Joining us also in Washington is Eric Bratberg. He's director of the Europe Program at the Carnegie Institute for International Peace. His writing has appeared in the Washington Post, the Financial Times, the Atlantic, many other publications. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Give us just a brief overview of how EU immigration policy has evolved since the beginning of this crisis a couple of years ago.
Well, I think it's a good opportunity to take stock of how EU migration policy has evolved now 2 years since really the migration crisis started in kind of the late summer of 2015. And I think it's fair to say that at the time, at the beginning of the crisis, it was clear that the EU did not have a strong migration policy to handle this crisis. And I think 2 years forward today, it's clear that while some progress has been made, there are still lots of shortcomings. And I think when you look at the different dimensions of EU migration policy, the external dimension of trying to address the root problem, trying to make sure that migrants don't reach Europe illegally. Some efforts have been made. The Turkey deal was
referenced. I mean, it seems like the policy in effect is to just almost to build a wall around the Mediterranean to keep the migrants in Libya and in Turkey in these staging grounds from which they come to Europe.
Yeah, I think that's a fair description, kind of build a European wall by externalizing the problem. The deal with Turkey was basically designed to have Turkey provide for the refugees so that they don't reach Europe, while in turn provide assistance to Turkey. The same type of arrangement, although it was very controversial, is now being replicated in Libya and in North Africa, which of course, as we're seeing with the route of refugees in the eastern part of the Mediterranean drying up. The big problem facing Europe right now is migrants coming to Italy and increasingly to Spain from North Africa. So that's why European countries are trying to sort of deal with these countries, provide assistance, but also to make sure that that's something that
Sure. Well, let me turn this just to Mike Gonzalez then. Tell us just a bit about the fault lines within Europe over how to address this.
Yeah, sure. I lost some of what Eric said because the communication fell. But briefly, I have sympathy for the refugees, some sympathy for them. And I also have sympathy for the European government. I think in the interviews that you conducted, for example, you saw how Medi does have a reasonable case to make under the Treaty on Refugees. He is a persecuted minority as a Shia in Balochistan. I suppose that as a Hazara, he came originally from Afghanistan. One has to question why he doesn't go back to Afghanistan. The West is spending a lot of money trying to make that country more inhabitable. But when you were interviewing, and we learned also from Mehdi that he's carrying smartphones. In the interview you have with Maya, as she said, a lot of the Eritreans are just trying to escape, not serving military service. That is not one of the cases under the UNHCR in which you can apply for refugee status.
I'm sorry, this is lifelong military service that we're talking about here. It's not just sort of like 2 years in.
No, I understand that, but that is still not one of the cases you can make to have a refugee status according to the UNHCR.
Well, I'm sorry, we hear Maya disputing that point here as well. But Eric Bratberg, if I could bring you into this discussion then as well, what are your responses on that?
Yeah, but clearly there are international regulations in place about who constitutes a refugee and who is an economic migrant. And we've seen this also in Europe with giving preference to people coming from war zones, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan to some extent, and not allowing economic migrants to come into European countries. But of course, as we saw during the 2015-2016 refugee crisis, differentiating between these different groups is difficult. Once the floodgates of migrants towards Europe opened, a lot of people move towards Germany and towards Northern Europe and other countries. So I think we're now seeing a more restrictive European approach, including from countries like Germany, in order to make Europe somewhat less attractive to people who are not just fleeing war zones, but also fleeing dire economic situations, be it in sub-Saharan Africa or in elsewhere in the Middle East or in Asia.
And Mike, it seems
right,
like...
But if we want to help the people who have a true case to make, somebody such as Mehdi, that he will face persecution because of his ethnicity and his religious affiliation, then we cannot just simply open to everybody, to economic migrants. You know, European states have very wealthy welfare states. You know, as Milton Friedman just put it, you cannot have welfare and open borders at the same time. They're mutually exclusive. So while we do want to, compassion is part of human nature, we do want to help them. We cannot, as Maya said, why can't everybody just get up and move? We could have that, but then you have to tear down the welfare state.
Well, let me turn this back to you then, Eric Bratberg, then, because part of what's happening now is that as this route across the Mediterranean from Turkey to Greece has been closed and migrants are being sent back to Turkey, in many cases if they're picked up at sea, is that there's been more pressure, more of the migration flows are going through Libya across to Italy and then from Morocco across to Spain. And there have been some agreements trying to keep the people in Libya, but there's been a lot of reporting that the conditions in which migrants there are living are just really horrible. I mean, there's a moral dimension to this as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. And of course, Libya is different from Turkey in that Libya sort of lacks a stable government. There's still, very divided and insecure country. So it's harder to deal with as Europe is trying to do so. And there has been a lot of human rights concerns about the situation in detention centers in Libya. And I think, that's just the reality of a place like Libya. But I think it's fair to say, as you're describing, that the European approach increasingly is to kind of, again, externalize this problem, have Libya deal with the refugees coming to there so that they don't reach Europe, while in turn try to provide assistance to Libya to handle that situation and to sort of work on a political settlement in that country and provide humanitarian assistance, while at the same time, increasing, and we've seen this over the past 2 years, increasing maritime security efforts into the Mediterranean to sort of prevent human smugglers bringing refugees to places like Italy and now increasingly Spain. And that's likely going to continue to be a priority for the Europeans before Libya is able to adequately handle the situation, which is likely to continue to remain a problem for a long time, given demographic and other trends, especially in sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, Mike,
I
mean,
saw this issue firsthand.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
Paris.
We just heard about demographic trends. Europe is aging. We did a little research. I think the median age in Germany is something like 46 now. Just across the Sahara, in Niger, Mali, the median age is 15. So, I mean, at some point, you're at a demographic tipping point here where it almost seems inevitable that a lot more people are just going to be coming and coming and coming.
I don't think that's the case. I mean, there are some governments in Europe that are taking this demographic issue very seriously and are doing some things about it. Obviously, one of the things that deters couples from having families is a very heavy tax load. But just to go back to the point that we were making just now, I saw the whole thing firsthand in Paris 3 weeks ago at the Eiffel Tower. I was there buying a trinket, a little Eiffel Tower, from one of the from a person who was obviously of African descent. And no sooner had I paid them, the police swooped in. They all fled immediately. This is what Maya was talking about, how they're constantly harassed and get them to go on the move. But 4 hours after I left the Eiffel Tower, the whole place had to be evacuated because a man screaming Allahu Akbar tried to stab a policeman. So, Europe is going through some really hard difficulties here that we need to take into account.
But sorry, so you raised this issue of potential terrorism here, and so you would make the link between the people who are crossing the Mediterranean and some of the issues with tourism that we, that we've seen recently in France, in the UK, in Spain. Your argument then is that by keeping people out, you're keeping a lid on terrorism then, is that right?
Just like it's in human nature to be compassionate, we have to balance that with the responsibility we have to protect our country, our families. In Germany alone, for example, the numbers that you had about the intake of refugees were not quite right. Germany has taken Germany itself, a country of 82 million people, has taken 2 million refugees recognized by the German government. It saw more incidents of terrorist attacks in 2016 than it saw for the entire 2000 to 2015 period. So yes, the increase has been huge. Angela Merkel has paid a heavy price for this, not so much in her electoral prospects, she looks like she's going to win, but a lot of other leaders in Europe are thinking twice before doing what she's done.
Eric, go ahead.
Well, obviously, I think this is a disputed point about the link of migration and terrorism, but certainly in some places of Europe, the perception that mass migration constitutes a security threat is very real. And I think that's why we've seen the migration crisis contribute to the rise of populist and xenophobic tendencies across Europe and had an influence, arguably, on several recent elections in European countries. So I think this is, while it's a disputed link, certainly in the perception of ordinary European citizens, it's in some cases very much a reality.
And
there have been instances in Stockholm, in Germany, in Spain, of people who came in, and definitely in Belgium and France, who came in with a refugee status, turning around and committing these acts of terrorism. ISIS itself has said repeatedly that it was going to use the migrant crisis as a cover to infiltrate Europe and radicalize Europe and try to get more people to join its cause.
Well, Mike, are there
the recruiters are working very
heavily.
Are there
lessons for this for U.S. policymakers here? I hear your point. Are there lessons for the U.S. in this, or is the context so different between Europe and the U.S. that the way we can address the problems is totally different?
There are some lessons. I mean, there was a very good Harvard paper written about the countries that exhibit have the worst risk of terrorism. The winning side hand that we have is that we still have a functioning melting pot, and so the percentage of attacks committed here are fewer. But also the attacks that are committed here are committed by people who are second generation, not the first generation immigrants, but people who were born here or the so-called 1.5 cohort, people who were brought in as children but are raised here. That was the case in San Bernardino. That was the case in Boston. That was the case in Orlando. So we have problems. We can look at what's happened in Europe as a cautionary tale. But our problems here are much better than they are in Europe.
And no Eric Bratberg, last word to you. Our time grows short.
Sure. Well, I think one dimension that's sort of unique to the European context that we don't have here in the United States is the difference between member states. And what we're seeing in Europe is sort of concerns about the uneven distribution of migrants, with some countries, Mike mentioned Germany, but of course also countries like Greece and Italy that are kind of bearing the brunt of the migration burden. And the inability of Europe to really have an internal migration policy to resettle and redistribute migrants in a way that would be more equitable. I think this is a very unique European problem, and it shows the challenges facing EU migration policy that are still unresolved and will continue to be so. And that really goes to the core of natural sovereignty and what the modern European project is all about.
Sorry, Eric, we're just out of time. That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Mindy Shams, Maya Conforti, Mike Gonzalez, and Eric Bratberg for joining us. For all of us at Global Journalist, thanks for tuning in.